Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today is Sunday, October 11th, 2020. And I'm here today with my wife at Joy of Napping. We are going to record another diary episode. People have been finding these to be a little bit useful, and so I thought we would take some time to reflect on all the events that have occurred over the course of the last week and a half or so. How's it going tonight at Joy of Napping?
You know, as you reflect that it's been a week and a half, it feels like I have lived about 3 years in the last week and a half.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a specific incident that you're anchoring on when you go back a week and a half.
Yeah, about a week and a half ago, the President of the United States was diagnosed with COVID-19. And
I'm going to stop you right there.
Yep.
About a week and a half ago, we found out that the president was diagnosed with COVID-19.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to talk about, during the course of this podcast episode, our thoughts on how that all went down, as well as some reflections on what else has been going on in culture over the course of the last week and a half, as well as some of the stuff that's been meaningful to us, some of the stuff that's been helping us to kind of stay sane a little bit. So that's what's in store for today's episode of the podcast. If you're enjoying this show, be sure to check out more episodes at culturallyrelevantshow.com or just search for Culturally Relevant on Apple Podcasts or wherever your podcast can be downloaded. And would love it if you could leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts or follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow, CrevShow. Also want to give a shout out to all my patrons at patreon.com/DaveChen. You are a big reason why I'm making the stuff I'm continuing to make. So let's dive into it, shall we, at Joy of Napping. Week and a half ago, we learned the president was diagnosed with COVID-19. You and I actually did a couple live broadcasts on Periscope. And I put some on my YouTube channel where we just kind of reacted to the day's news. It felt like news was happening even more quick. Like the rate of news seems to be accelerating, and yeah, it was already going really, really quickly, right?
I think we're reaching rapidly some sort of like asymptotic point where maybe like time then folds in on itself.
Yes.
Or yeah, we create some sort of rift in the continuum of the fabric of space and time. Perhaps actually we have already done so and I just don't even know it.
It's very possible. So I think that during those live broadcasts, the first reaction I felt when I found out that the president had been diagnosed with coronavirus was fear. Fear that this would be no big deal for him, that he would be able to benefit from this or use the situation politically. And I feel like a lot of that stuff has come to pass, you know? I don't wish any person to perish, you know? I didn't wish that he would die, but I did hope that his case would be serious enough that it would somehow prompt him to take the situation more seriously, right? That if he had developed some severe case or something that would like visibly prevent him from like acting normally, that it would somehow create some kind of change. Because one word that I've been thinking about when it comes to this president is the term solipsistic. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that like nothing exists for this president beyond himself. Like he doesn't understand any experiences except for his own. He doesn't have any sympathy for people. He doesn't have empathy. You know, like he can't understand any experiences beyond what he experiences.
But I would really challenge that. I don't think he actually understands his own experiences either.
Fair enough.
Which is, and to the extent he does, he is absolutely willing to obfuscate and outright lie about it. So I think I hear what you're saying, and that's only one element of a toxic stew.
Yeah, but anyway, I think that's what I was hoping, is that, hey, it will be like debilitating enough that like it'll be visibly obvious even to his followers that this is something that's worth taking seriously. To this moment, as we are recording this right now, there is still a huge percentage of the American population that does not take COVID seriously, that thinks it's a hoax. Like literally thinks it's a hoax that has been fabricated to take down Trump, or thinks its impact has been widely exaggerated. And my biggest fear is that the president contracting coronavirus would feed into this, right? Like, because he would be able to overcome it. And that seems to have been what has occurred.
I mean, I really don't even know what to say. First of all, I think it's, you know, I'm a fan of yours, you know, as a human, and that's why I agreed to get legally bound to you. And I think it's actually really lovely that your greatest concern was like, what would this mean for the health of other people? Mm-hmm. Because you really do want other people to take it seriously so that we can all protect ourselves and get through this, you know, with just fewer deaths of people who don't have the resources that somebody in his position has.
Yes.
So first of all, that's a thumbs up to you as an empathetic human being, even if it means one person has to get visibly a little more sick. You know, like I think that's what you were saying is the amount of scrutiny on him that would be could be valuable, like as a public service announcement, basically. I think the thing is, unfortunately, that there's kind of no. I've come to the conclusion in the last, you know, 10 days or 9 days or whatever it's been, that there's actually no outcome that would have created what you wanted. Like I think people really believe he got COVID. I think a lot of his supporters are less likely to think it's a hoax so much as it's like, oh, well, there's nothing he could have done. Oh, like it's not important to socially distance because who could have seen this coming? Or who, you know, maybe masks don't matter. I think there's like a lot of like milder versions of than outright denial that are at play here. And I think, you know, there are also some pretty weird conspiracy theories out there like that, oh, all of these Republicans have gotten it because it's like a Democratic assassination plot, or, you know, that on some level, the shortest distance between two points is all these people got it because they don't believe in taking precautions. But I think almost any outcome could have been tortured into something that was going to basically, I don't think there was an outcome that could have gotten to the great public service announcement that you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. That basically, like, we are already seeing lots of tortured logic like, oh, well, if the president could get it, then literally, why are we even trying to do anything to prevent it? You know, and that is a Republican talking point that's been rolled out. So I think you're probably right that, like, no matter what the outcome would have been, they would have said or done something to kind of twist it into something that was, quote unquote, advantageous to them. I don't actually think it's advantageous to them, but like, that would benefit their current trajectory, which is pretending the virus doesn't exist.
Well, or minimizing it. I mean, yeah. I think the other thing is that because the super spreader event took out a lot of the White House staff itself, and reportedly a bunch of the White House staff that isn't sick is like terrified now of getting sick or showing up to work. You're still made fun of for wearing a mask at the White House. Apparently they like see Trump coming and they physically like recoil, and people are avoiding him. You know, the whatever machinery existed to keep his worst impulses at bay, which according to articles I've read, really requires you to physically be in person with him and be the last person he spoke to. You know, that is your best shot of changing his mind or curbing, yeah, again, his sort of random ideas. Well, a lot of that machinery is at home on Zoom or ill. And so there's no one to stop him from what has been incredibly erratic behavior. I mean, I think the most likely scenario, people like argue maybe he's like hopped up on steroids, maybe he's not feeling well. I think this might kind of be just how he is all the time, with the steroids or not. They may exacerbate some underlying tendencies, but they don't create them out of whole cloth. And what I'm saying is, like, there was how much he got sick, but then there were the narrative that was told about it. And the narrative that is told about it is bananas. It is bananas what he has been allowed to say. And, of course, his, I think, frankly, exhausted and frustrated, you know, party has to pick up these points and then they have to go sell them on Fox News or wherever. And the talking points are, Regeneron is amazing. It will be made free to everyone, even though it's made out of stem cells. You know.
Well, hold on. Let's get to that. Let me before we get to the Regeneron and that whole thing. I just want to take a moment and pause to reflect on the fact that, like just the sheer tonnage of stuff that happened in the last week and a half in terms of like every development seemed so major. The idea that like, hey, it's positive. It's possible that Trump was already positive at the time of his debate with Joe Biden.
I think almost certainly he was. Yeah.
Several days prior to that, there was this Amy Coney Barrett kind of unveiling that happened in the Rose Garden that some people believed to be a super spreader event, although it was not the only event. Like, there were people who then ended up getting it that weren't at the event, but it's like many people at the event, which took place outdoors and indoors, got it. And I mean, that is significant. The vice president of the United States this past week did a debate with Kamala Harris where he appeared to have conjunctivitis and a fly landed on him for 2 minutes. And people started.
And one of those two things is a sign of COVID.
People started speculating wildly that he has coronavirus. And it's not like he's confirming that he's tested negative in the last couple of days, as far as I know. The Senate GOP has basically, many people, including Lindsey Graham, are refusing to take a test. They're refusing to get tested for this disease that is extremely contagious and possibly deadly because they think that getting tested positive could jeopardize their attempt to ram through this Supreme Court nomination weeks before a presidential election. So, and I'm not even referring to all like the photo ops that occurred, right? President Trump out there in a Secret Service vehicle, waving feebly through a window while wearing a mask and potentially endangering his own people as well as the medical staff. The return to the White House, standing on the balcony in a very fascistic way,
taking saluting to no one.
Saluting to, well, I think he's saluting to Marine One, but
I think Marine One might be gone. Like, I think it's just for the editing, right? Like, it was just for the video.
But like ripping off the mask in a dramatic fashion, and then sending out like these bizarre videos, which have since been edited into Tim and Eric like supercuts that is like make him look like a used car salesman talking about Regeneron. All of that stuff happened in the last week and a half. So it just is like we were trying to cover this daily, and then you know I felt we got some good reflections in there. But even at that pace, we were barely keeping up with everything that was happening. So okay, I just wanted to say a lot has happened. It's extremely difficult to like comprehend and process it all. And if you're having difficulty, that's very normal. All that said, in one of his most recent videos, he was basically saying, first of all, he said, hey, COVID is not a big deal. Don't let it dominate your life, is what he said, which A, is heartbreaking to hear him say. B, I actually read this article on BuzzFeed that was like, lots of people like switching their votes from Trump because he said that, because they've had people who have died from COVID, right? Like anyone who's actually impacted by this, I think, will find his behavior in this regard reprehensible. And so anyway, that's like the whole, like, let's not let this dominate your life. I just, it really, really deeply upset me, in a way that I didn't know that I could be upset anymore.
But here's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Even if he had gotten visibly sick, he would have still, I don't know, found someone to put a pound of makeup on his face, and he still would have propped himself up for 45 seconds to make a video that would have said, don't let this dominate your life. Like, he because he is, the message has to be, COVID's not that big of a deal. It has to be, right? Like, he, and there's no one to stop him or to say, hey, could you just tone it down a little bit and say, like, COVID is very important for us to all take care of.
Right.
And, you know, it was unavoidable that it happened to me, and I'm blaming China, and take care of yourselves out there. You know, like, that would have been a reasonable middle path between what he's doing now and like some empathy for the families of the 214,000 people who have died.
As I reflect back on the last week, it's like one of the stories that came out was his father, Fred Trump, I think, was very against showing any sign of weakness, even via illness. There's this idea in, like, I guess, toxic masculinity / the current GOP rhetoric that, like, getting sick is somehow, like, a sign of weakness, right? And
well, I actually think it's not uncommon. He also, Fred Trump Jr., was very uncomfortable with illness of anybody in the family, including his own wife, you know, and it was, he almost had a toxic positivity is how it was described by his niece, Mary Trump, which is like, oh, if we admit this, then like the whole thing comes crumbling down. And I've known a number of people in America. Like, so we're immigrants, and I'm not trying to say it's uniquely American, but I sort of wonder if it is, that there's this stoicism where a friend of mine described her grandmother falling down and breaking her hip and refusing to be helped up off the ground because it was like, no, 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 it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. And then like, clearly sometimes you cannot get off the ground on your own, but she was just talking about her family was from Pennsylvania. And kind of this Midwestern, like, just cannot admit any kind of weakness.
Yeah, and it's suffused throughout American society. Using, like, to this day, continuing to use, like, warrior/battle language around cancer and other diseases. Like, so-and-so lost their battle with cancer. Still in headlines in major newspapers.
Yeah, or when
day.
People are like, fight through it, stay strong. It's like, are some people fighting harder than others? Like, that's a common narrative.
It's so painful for me to read it. I'm just like, we need to get away from this language.
Well,
you
know? It's very ableist.
Yes.
Right?
So anyway, it's fascinating to me, the kind of the chain of causality from like Fred Trump Jr., who's like, never show weakness, never feel like you're sick. Like, if you're sick, we're going to like treat you really badly in the family. That passed down to Trump, who like obviously has carried it out over the course of the last week and a half.
So that millions of us can now get sick and ignore it?
Correct. So that like people will die because of what he said and did. And needlessly, you know, it's just, it's tragic. It's tragic and it breaks my heart. Okay. So people die. And then, but then like beyond just like the sick mind of one man, it's all these people around him who refuse to do anything about it.
So I want to go back to, you know, I think you're trying to take a little bit of a longitudinal view of these 10 dizzying days. And, you know, you said your initial reaction was fear and your worst fear has come true. And I'll just tell you, I had all the reactions. I mean, people can go back and watch the recording. I think it's on YouTube. And I felt very overwhelmed for many of the last 10 days. And I, you know, any day where nothing major happens, I spend
we're suspicious.
Like, right. Doom scrolling, trying to find the thing, like looking for the buried treasure of badness. Anyway, so I'm just going to tell you, I know you're highly superstitious and you're very negative, but I think it might be going great. I think it might be going great. It's going very badly in that more people will die as a result of this behavior. But in my view, there was no scenario in which he wasn't going to minimize it. And it was, do you know what I mean? I feel like just like very few people's minds are actually able to be made up at this point about the election. I think very few people's minds are swayable about COVID.
What like about all the undecided voters after napping? All those undecided voters out there that can't decide.
The 2% that could literally like pick anyone.
Got to cater to those people.
Joe Jorgensen, a name I only recently heard. I think that I feel that his horrible, horrible debate performance and his callous disregard for other people in his handling of COVID,
including his own staff and the Secret Service,
the extremely confusing, like totally self-inflicted problems with all the timeline issues around his health information, you would think that if there was ever a time to get the A team for comms to just align on one fucking story,
this would be it.
When the president is infected with an illness that is potentially deadly and more deadly for people with his specific comorbidities of obesity, being man, and being older. And they have no story. He himself obviously is part of the lack of discipline, but also the staff feels like they're like literally not talking to each other. And I think all of these things put together have an overwhelming takeaway for many people, which is what no matter what you think of someone's policies, like the temperament of him plus the staff is completely dysfunctional. And the staff is unable to operate with him as like a functioning unit to govern. And I think it is, that point is just made so abundantly clear. I honestly think it was pretty clear before. Okay. But like with the debate where he like could not restrain himself from just interrupting Joe Biden. Yes, like on important points, but also on very, very unimportant points. It's just clear this man cannot be held to any sort of discipline. And so if after all of this, America ends up with a more or less free and fair election in which people chose this, then America gets what it deserves. Like, that's really kind of where I am on it. Like, it's all out on the table. It's all there for you to pick from. I was listening to an episode of The Daily, in which they spoke to Trump voters in Pennsylvania County, Luzerne, I think it is. Have you heard this?
No, I know it was a recent episode.
And, you know, people were talking about why they support Trump, and I completely get it from their perspective. There's a huge number of formerly Democratic voters, people who voted for Obama multiple times, who have switched their party registration in the past few years to Republican. And these, you know, if these people basically are the linchpin of this country, if they are where the power lies, then good for them. They won. They can have the country. I think it's incredibly tragic and depressing, but because it's not aligned with my vision for the country.
Right.
But I see how they got there, and I see how we got here. And there's no, for me, debating. Is he secretly like a great deal maker? Is he actually going to drain the swamp? Like, he built himself a new, bigger, special swamp. That's another thing that's come out in the last 10 days is another New York Times investigation into his taxes.
Oh, remember the taxes? That was 2 weeks ago.
Yep. That was just a couple days before the debate.
Yep.
You know, so I hope that you understand what I'm saying is that you had a certain fear. I actually had a certain aspiration, which is that this would actually just tilt the election. Because to me, more lives are impacted, not by what he says or doesn't about COVID. It's already so bad. We're failing so badly. And the best thing we can do is have like an administration come in that believes in science.
Yeah.
And I think to the extent that these past however many days have swayed some minds, I actually think it has swayed some minds.
I think you're right. So when you
and
say
not towards Donald Trump.
There's so many people that have said it. Here's a guy who's obviously handled things in a way that's led to over 220,000 deaths and is actively infecting people around him, is himself a super spreader.
But I believe I'll get that free Regeneron.
There was a really interesting piece that Hamilton Nolan wrote for inthesetimes.com. He wrote it in the wake of the debate, and I'll read a section from it to you. He says, quote, "I'm supposed to have written a review of last night's presidential debate. Here's my review. You have spent a lifetime ripping everyone off. Your enemies finally catch up to you, hit you with a baseball bat, and tie you up. One of them holds up an enormous needle full of heroin. How do you want to go out? The fun way, or we just leave you here to starve? Maybe with great effort, you could chew your own arm off and break free of the restraints. But that would require so much suffering. Why not just float into oblivion? You rack your mind, straining for something to give you the will to fight for your life. You think of your kids, good for nothing. Your bank account, empty. Your prospects for a brighter future, nil. You have only sin in your past and doom in your future. The temptation to give up is overwhelming. You close your eyes, poised on the precipice of despair. Then, very faintly, you see a light in the distance of your imagination. You float towards it, hoping against hope for a message from God that will bless you with the strength to find your way to salvation. At last you arrive at the light. It is bright, blinding. It is a bright, blinding set of dentures. Here's the deal, a voice says. I'm Joe Biden. Election day is 34 days away. It's a very compelling piece, but his idea was basically that, like, people, I should say that's the end of the quote. People, there's something like thrillingly self-destructive about voting for Trump, I think is his like kind of thesis of the piece, is that like, hey, like, it's not like life was going well for a lot of the people voting for Trump anyway. I'm not saying that's true for everyone voting for Trump, but like for a lot of people, it's not like the government was treating them super well or life was treating them super well. And there's some kind of like thrill of self-annihilation that is at least fun to watch. I'm not saying that's my belief. I'm just saying like,
I think that's completely condescending. And I think it's not. The people that I know who would vote for Trump, I don't think they would at all agree with that.
So you think they actually literally believe it's the best path forward?
Absolutely, they think it's the best path forward.
Interesting, yeah. Okay, well, people can I'll link to the piece. People can read and decipher yourself. I think there's something, you know, true about what you're saying. So, but yes, to your point, I think that probably very few people have seen what has happened in the last couple of weeks and said, that's my guy. I know now for sure.
Yeah. People that weren't already convinced. I think another thing that's pretty important in the last 10 days is that, or I guess that this one will stretch us to 12, that in the debate, he claimed he's like, I don't know any white supremacist groups, but I'll denounce, give me one. Hey, white supremacist group I supposedly don't know the name of. Stand down and stand by.
Stand back and stand by, I believe, was the phrase.
Oh, yeah, stand back and stand by. Because your boy's got some business that you might need to finish come November 3rd. I mean, it was really, really amazing that you can see he's like about to sort of say to truly, but like he can't get himself to say it. So he says something like he does this thing all the time where he says things that are menacing but vague so that he can't really be theoretically called on it in the future.
There is something very, I'm going to say, skillful about the way he does this. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
He goes right up to the line where he can have plausible deniability and then kind of steps back from
it. Well, it's always like, oh, well, a lot of people are saying, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of people are
I'm
saying.
I'm not saying I'm saying it, but a lot of people are. I hear it on the streets.
I mean, but you don't know.
But you don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, wink. So in the wake of this, it happens that the FBI managed to foil a plot by 13 people calling themselves the Wolverine Minutemen or the Wolverine whatever Patriots to kidnap the governor of Michigan because she apparently is a fascist for wanting people to wear masks and for closing down the economy. Things that many people, governors in other states, did. I don't know if it's because she's a woman as well, but they seem to really, really dislike her. And they had a, plot to kidnap other governors and overthrow our state governments. I think this does reveal a very poor understanding of how state governments function and how many people you would need aligned in order to actually pull this off any states. But
you're saying it's a sign that our education system has failed us. Basically.
Well, two of the people were ex-Marines, which I thought was fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I think that A, civics education could be improved, and B, more importantly, we don't have to wait, for the radicalizing to show. I mean, it's here already. It's here already. And I know many people who believe there will be violence no matter what.
When the election happens.
Yeah.
I think this is very, very possible.
Now, if we're lucky, it'll be like little smatterings of violence here and there as opposed to like open conflict.
Well, I would say that the protests that have occurred over the course of the last few months, like, have given us a taste of what might happen if the government tries to invalidate the results of the election, I would say.
Like, what do you... Well, so first of all, government invalidating the results of the election, unfortunately, is in like the eye of the beholder.
Sure.
So Joe Biden is basically out there with a 10.3% averaged, national polling lead, telling people like, don't get complacent. We need to crush it so that we don't end up in like months of state, you know, state by state recount battles. And I think that's actually true. So the margin must be overwhelming. In the case the margin's not overwhelming, which I really fear, that it's not even close, but it's close-ish in a couple of important states, Florida and Pennsylvania. You know, that we might have ongoing conflict, ongoing self-appointed militias going outside courthouses to like try to intimidate judges or lawyers, and protests that are peaceful, but in which like one or two things like happen and it escalates and gets out of control.
Yeah, I was thinking more like even if it was overwhelming and Trump refused to step down, I think people would take to the streets. You know, I think there would be. I remember like in the days following Trump's election, there was the Women's March, right? Yes. And there's like millions of people around the country, kind of marching. And that was way before all of this shit happened.
Yeah.
And all of the shit meaning all the terrible things that happened in the Trump administration. And that was just kind of like an expression to be like expression of this. Hey, by the way, we're still here. You know, we still believe in women's rights. And FYI, even though you got elected, like there's still like a bunch of us. And you know, compare that to if the results are very clear who the winner is, and it is Joe Biden, and they still try to deny, invalidate, deceive, obfuscate, inveigle, whatever.
That's a good one.
X-Files thing. So. I think, you know, people will take to the streets and we'll see what results of that is. This is a prediction. I am not inciting people to do so.
People taking to the streets, in my view, is highly positive and violence is quite negative. So sure. There was no violence associated with the women's marches, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And really, the overwhelming majority of the Black Lives Matter protests have also been peaceful. I know that people love to see a photo of one trash can on fire in a downtown somewhere and then claim that American cities are burning. But you know, that's like the rhetoric that goes with it. But I just want to be really, really careful that literally the violence I fear is that, I'll be really blunt, is that white Trump supporters will shoot or punch or, you know, vandalize or set fire to Black-owned businesses or other, you know, minority-owned businesses or harm minority people. As an Asian-presenting person myself, I am planning to spend the week after Election Day hiding. I, like, don't particularly plan to show my face. Oh, by the way, that's news to you.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with me. So, we'll see what happens. We're obviously going to watch the results with great interest and hope that everyone will be safe. Anyway, a few other things that, are topics of discussion just stirred up. Also, like, there's been so many social media cycles since in the last couple weeks. Like, you were talking about Trump refusing to denounce the Proud Boys, and like the whole co-opting of the Proud Boys hashtag on Twitter has, I think, happened in that time.
Yes.
Or maybe before it, maybe predated it, but like Proud Boys has been co-opted as like a gay hashtag, like for gay pride, which has been like incredible to watch.
And then the Proud Boys have they really rebranded themselves? Is that really true?
I'm not sure about that. I had read that they had rebranded themselves Leathermen, but I'm not.
That feels a
little too on the nose to be true. But anyway, obviously, like Mike Pence and like a fly landing on his head was the highlight of the debate, which shows you the fact that like not that much happened. Like there was not that much that was like outrageous at the debate. I do just want to pause and reflect on the fact that Pence lies a lot in his debates. You know, I was stunned.
Yeah, he's a mild-mannered piece of shit. I hate him.
I was stunned at it when I saw the debate in 2016, him and Tim Kaine. And it was like, what is Mike Pence's strategy going to be for like debating Tim Kaine when Tim Kaine like accuses him and his president of all these terrible things? And his strategy was just to literally lie. It was just to to deny. He'll just say, like, that's not true, and say things that, like, I mean, I, you know, the fact that he's debating a woman, more people use the term gaslight, you know, to describe what he was doing. I don't remember that term being used when he was, like, debating Tim Kaine, but, like, you know, in a way he was gaslighting the country. And it does just really rub me the wrong way, because he is theoretically a very devout evangelical Christian.
That's actually why I hate him. Because I think he actually gives Christianity, like, a horrible name.
Yeah.
It's, like, in order to get some of the things you care about, like having a likely reversal of Roe v. Wade and a, you know, rollback of LGBTQ rights, those things are so important that he will personally lie his face off, serve the most immoral and corrupt president in the history of this country, and actually provide the veneer of respectability that allows it all to happen. So it's not like he's just taking orders. He is creating the entire system that allows this to happen. There are many people who are Christian conservatives who are voting for a serial sexual assaulter because they have this pact, basically, with the Mike Pence wing, which is, well, as long as Pence is there, I believe that my longer-term policy goals will be fulfilled, even if it means literally selling our souls. And I think it's a horrible example to set of what it means to live your values. And I think it's deeply, it is itself so corrupt that it, in the moral system that Mike Pence believes in, does he really think, like, at the pearly gates, they'll be like, well, on net, good job.
It's staggering to me at Joy of Napping. It's staggering to me. As someone who grew up in the church, like, I went from being a devout Christian to being an agnostic, being like, oh, I'm not sure if this is true, you know, still investigating, still on my own faith journey, to the evangelical church must be stopped. Like, is what I believe right now, because they're actively imperiling not only the future of this country, but I would argue actually humanity. Anyway.
And to be clear, I'm not an evangelical Christian, but I can see the argument for opposing abortion. I can see it.
Oh, me too.
Right? Completely. You could totally argue that life begins at conception. And there are many people who are Christian, evangelical or not, who really consistently believe that, okay, then I should also oppose the death penalty. Then I should also believe in the quality of life once people are born. Then I should, you know, like, basically take that maxim and sort of apply it broadly, who believe in charity and forgiveness and generosity. And I think that the idea that you can cafeteria style some of these policies and elevate a handful and then isolate other people from the church if they don't pick the same handful that you picked is deeply, deeply upsetting to me.
Yeah, I mean... So, couple of things. First of all, I agree that there is a, like, coherent,
yes,
there is a coherent argument for like the pro-life side. I don't necessarily agree with it, but, like, there's people that do agree with it. But, like, what we're seeing, in my opinion, is, like, complete incoherence on the Christian side. It's like pro-life does not only, you know, there was this joke that was told, like, that evangelical Christians believe life begins at conception and ends at birth, right? And, like, after you're born, they don't give a shit. Like,
that's honestly how it feels, which is so cacophonous. And, you know, so does that mean that then we don't care about immigrants or refugees at all? That they're, like, not human, and that if anyone attempts to immigrate to this country, God forbid, that they then lose all human rights, including the right to have their children with them in detention, or that outcomes across race show so much disparity across every major socioeconomic indicator, whether it's education, income, health access, health outcomes, you know, like income, wealth. It's so depressing. And are we okay, like, just reinforcing that as long as no one got aborted along the way?
Right. It is just so incoherent and, yeah, like, it would be one thing if there was like, hey, like, we need to take care of all people. And that includes, like, being pro-life, you know, no abortions. And by the way, all those other things you said.
Yes,
like,
and also care of our vulnerable people. Right, also vulnerable people who are disabled.
Then it's like, okay, I might not agree with that, but at least I get it.
Wouldn't you be pro-access to healthcare then?
Right.
You know,
it's
like,
it's just complete nonsense incoherence. Anyway, on that note, and the other thing I wanted to say, actually, before I get to this, is that, like, I mean, there's a verse in the Bible that talks about exactly this point. It's like, what does it, my biblical memory might not be exactly as it was when I was a kid, but it's like, what does it gain a man to gain the whole world, but to lose his soul? It's basically like, there's a verse that's like, oh, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world, but to lose his soul? I think it's something like that. And it's basically like, even if you are a fan of the policies that Trump is putting out, you have to consider the methods and the techniques and all the collateral damage along the way. There is this guy who, every time I see news of this guy, it like makes my blood boil. I'll link to an article in the Washington Post. This is Christian worship leader brings controversial prayer rallies to cities roiled by protests.
Oh, this guy. He came to Seattle, right?
Yeah, he came to Seattle.
Oh my God.
Sean Fucht. F-E-U-C-H-T. A California-based worship leader opened a promotional video from Kenosha by pointing to a parking lot of burned cars that he claimed were destroyed in recent protests of the shooting of Jacob Blake by a city police officer. And he said, quote, "We are believing in this place of devastation. God is releasing a sound of hope and healing and peace and unity," Fucht said in the video. "And that's what we're coming to bring today." End quote. The concerts have drawn criticism for bringing together hundreds or thousands of people, most without masks, during the coronavirus pandemic. Fellow Christians have expressed frustration at what they see as Fucht trying to overshadow people protesting systemic racism and the use of force by police.
Yeah, in Seattle, they like baptized each other in these pools of water that felt like incredible vectors for COVID, like even more effective than like licking each other's nostrils. Because you could have many people in one pool of water and then put them all through it.
It's just this guy is the personification, in my opinion, of everything wrong with the current evangelical. If Mike Pence is one side of the spectrum, then this guy is the other side. Where I was listening to a Patreon podcast by an author named D.L. Mayfield, and she was talking about how, like, this guy, there's this kind of complex in the Christian church of like, hey, like, worship can fix everything, you know, like worshiping God can fix the problems of like systemic racism and stuff like that, and that's why these people are gathering and holding revivals in places where like masks are required and public gatherings are forbidden, and they're like defying those because they're like, there's this Christian persecution complex of like, hey, like, even though the government says we can't do this, we're gonna do it because God cannot be silenced, blah blah blah. And so this persecution complex, which is like completely invented, and then on top of that, there is this kind of reappropriation of this racial injustice and like, hey, in order to bring healing, let's go to these places and sing praise songs. And, you know, D.L. Mayfield pointed out, like, Jesus didn't spend a lot of time in the Bible singing praise songs, to be honest. And even though, like, that's something that Christians spend a lot of time doing in the world today. And I never thought about it that way. But anyway, it feels like this is a guy who is not only potentially creating super spreader events, but amplifying the pain that is being caused by a lot of these events by like showing blatant disregard for seemingly the sanctity of what has happened, like the things that have happened at those places, and also kind of papering over it with this kind of very ineffectual veneer of white evangelical Christianity. It's infuriating. So anyway, I wish there was something I could do to stop these people, but you know, I can't. So all I have to do is just, I can denounce them on occasion and that's it. But I just, my heart rages whenever I read about these guys because it just is so damaging what they're doing.
Well, it's sort of like, it's an experience that I've had many times as a woman, probably honestly being Chinese American, it has not been as relevant in that context, but where I go to someone to tell them about a terrible thing that happened, you know, in a meeting or in a, you know, a microaggression that's occurred, or I'm ready to complain to the manager, basically. And like that person not only does not believe you, but like decides to take their own interpretation of events and spin up a whole bunch of flail that does not address anything you just said.
Great analogy.
And so it's like exhausting, yes, because you actually feel worse as a result. This is what actually leads, I think, to a lot of silence around racial injustice in sort of day-to-day interactions, because people just don't trust each other to listen. And instead, for a whole bunch of what I would label white nonsense to just go off and have a life of its own, because that is the white people coping with how it makes the white people feel when they see the protests. It does nothing for the black people.
Yeah. It upsets me so much. And I don't talk about it very much because there is, in fact, nothing I can do about it. But I burn with rage. And I feel like if God exists, he would burn with rage too. That's how strongly I feel about it. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I really am not an expert on any religious history in the U.S., but I feel at a deep level that Black Lives Matter is a moral movement and that it has attracted so many followers who themselves would not have ascribed to, you know, felt comfortable with that slogan 2 years ago or 3 years ago, because on some level, this summer's events were glass shattering for so many people. And I think the thing I keep coming back to is I think for many, and many of my colleagues who are white, who are just coming to these realizations about how racism works in America, I think they have an underlying precept that this is like morally unacceptable. And if we tell ourselves we live in a moral society, that this cannot stand. So I am hopeful that despite this very flashy evangelical Christian protest, I think a lot of what makes it so highly visible is because it's occurring in an era of COVID and there are so few public events of any kind right now. But I'm hoping it's a lot less of that, and there's a lot more silent majority staying home, wearing their masks, looking out for each other, and maybe like reading Isabel Wilkerson's new book called Cast. Highly recommended.
Would that it were so simple. I mean, I think that you're right. There probably is a silent majority. And
or a silent some percentage.
But yeah, I mean, Jesus didn't spend his time singing praise songs and spreading a deadly disease to all the people gathered together. He spoke out against injustice and fought against injustice and like really cared for the downtrodden and the people that couldn't care for themselves. And that's when I think of Jesus and his teachings, that's what I come away with. And this guy is advocating a perversion of them. Okay. Let's talk about happier things.
Yeah. I don't want to spend any more time on Mr. Fucked.
Let's not speak of Mr. Fucked ever again. All right. So a few happy things have happened. Okay. One of them is we have officially launched our COVID bubble.
Oh my goodness. It is so amazing.
I talked a little bit about this on last time's diary episode, but basically, we are in a COVID bubble with someone who moved in next door. Her name is Carter. She'll probably be in some podcasts and videos that I make in the future because she's going to be the only person we see on a fairly regular basis.
And she will provide relief from an overtaxed at joy of napping. So, yes, it's all working.
Yeah. She's
a delightful human being who really takes joy in, like, art. You know, like, the things that she enjoys, her stories, as she calls them, whether that's, like, TV shows or film or whatever. She really she just gets so excited, and it's infectious, that excitement to get to be around her. But I also think she'll bring a lot. She knows a lot about film and TV, and will bring a lot to the discussions with you.
So yeah, our friend Carter moved in a couple weeks ago, and basically all three of us are adhering to a set of rules. We're also like doing a fairly decent job of like logging any events that we partake in that might be risky. As I explained on last time's episode, one of the biggest challenges is finding someone who has the same level of risk as you, right? And so that's been a big challenge. But I feel like we've talked it over, and somebody who is like open to talking about it, because most people are very not open to talking about it, or ever like, and this is, there's been a couple things that I've learned over the course of the last couple of weeks, or have been reinforced. One thing is that, people often misestimate how careful their friends are, because you think your friends think like you do. You're like, oh, well, I've been wiping down my groceries. Surely my friends are. And they assume that, and they don't ask that question. They don't ask, they don't talk to their friends about it. And I think that's something that Carter has been open to, is like, basically, we talk about literally everything. And the bubble wouldn't work unless we were okay and super comfortable talking about everything, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes. And, you know, I am actually kind of in two bubbles. So the other tentacle is that my brother has a newborn, and the newborn has virtually no immune system because he's newly born. And there was a very, very strict set of circumstances under which I could see my nephew. I didn't meet my nephew for the first 2 months. And
of his existence.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, what my brother basically laid out in a Google document was like, here are the conditions under which I can, the mother and I, you know, can, feel comfortable with you coming over. And it's not unbearably strict, but it's pretty strict. But the number one thing, like at the bottom in bold, is things will happen. We just need to communicate about it.
Yep.
And I think that idea we would have had anyway in approaching our bubble with Carter. But and by the way, the rules across both are at parity with each other. So of course, if I start to have a sniffle, I will shield myself from both sets. And I guess you could think of it as a mega bubble, although it's like pretty unlikely that Carter's going to go to my brother's house. But like it effectively means we are all in one sort of risk path together. And I think the thing that has really struck me is the communication's important, because you'll unexpectedly have a dentist visit where you don't know going in like what the situation will be and whether you can maintain distance and everyone will have masks. But also the science is evolving. And so everything is constantly changing. And if you don't have someone you really have that openness with,
yeah,
it feels like it could rapidly just fall apart into like a good idea that you never quite followed through on.
Yeah. Or it could descend into like recriminations and accusations and unpleasantness, you know? But yeah, no, Carter is comfortable with our, so far, she's comfortable with our level of restrictions and also like the amount that we need to communicate with people. And that's been great. So that's one thing, is the communication, the not assuming things. You know, like not just because you think something, they believe something, like that's just, don't assume that that's the case.
Well, I want to just jump in that I think you probably are going to release like a whole separate thing about the bubble and how the bubble works.
I'm planning to make a YouTube video about it, yes.
But for the sake of this discussion, I think part of why we're talking about all the caveats and the rules is that she moved in a couple weeks ago, but we didn't actually start the bubble until yesterday.
Correct.
Because risk events kept occurring, and like the move itself, there were movers, and you know, like we want to just be ultra sure. And then she decided at one point, I had like a little sore throat for a few days, so I took a COVID test. Then that takes a couple days to get back. She took a COVID test, that took a couple days to get back. And then finally, like literally the moment her COVID test results were released, we were like, it's on, it's on. So that day, which was yesterday, we got to have a lovely dinner together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's only been I guess not even, but definitely not 48 hours. Yeah, that we've been bubbling. And it is freaking delightful. I mean, we definitely had seen each other as neighbors outdoors. So we have like a patio where we could sort of stay apart. And we had a couple of dinners out there and a couple of coffees. And that's, you know, also been delightful. I mean, anytime you can have a good friend as a neighbor, I think is awesome. And we were fortunate to have great neighbor friends in the past who moved away. And we were fortunate to have great neighbor friends in the past, comma, and they moved away, which was sad. You know, I just think there's like in this time, especially the amount of isolation and the feeling that you're kind of doing everything on your own and that there are so few, many of the ways you might kind of lean on other people to help you, like just feel unavailable. It's really been lovely to start to feel like we're building a community.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been amazing. And that was the second thing I was going to bring up is just that, like, the idea that there's somebody else who has our back, right? And vice versa, is a huge deal. Like that we can like basically take care of each other, and like cook each other meals and things like that. A few weeks ago, I talked about this topic and how like I think the family unit needs to be reconsidered. Somebody actually, one of my listeners actually sent me to culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com, sent me an email about this Naomi Klein podcast that talked about the exact same topic. And how, if you think about it, our current society is not organized in such a way that allows people to like share resources easily. We're divided into like single family homes, and the way property rights have been organized, the way food systems have been designed, have all been around single family homes. And it's like pretty inefficient and not adaptable, and certainly not great for the current situation we're all living in. So I'll link to the Naomi Klein podcast in the show notes. Thanks to the listener who sent me that. But that
really resonates with me because being Chinese, you know, you're more used to multi-generational living. My ideal home is barely for sale in the, you know, not even for sale. It barely exists, much less is on the market in this area, which would be like a house which does not need to be fancy, but which would have enough space for like a separate area for my parents and a separate area for your parents. And, you know, if we had children, you know, just some flexibility and modularity to like kind of accommodate different generations and, you know, not a lot of stairs to climb for elderly people. And
you know, there's just like those houses, very few of them actually exist, right?
And you can totally imagine that if we had a different set of values as a culture, that's the house that would get built, and there would be tons of demand for it.
Right,
and
right.
And
our lives would be better today because of that.
The Chinese people I know and the Indian people I know like snap up that kind of property, or they try to build it themselves because we're all trying to find a way to accommodate.
Yeah,
our beliefs, honestly. Like I value my parents. I don't want them to grow old taking care of themselves 100%. I think that's absurd, and I want them to have a feeling of independence, and I want them to know that like I'm there for them.
That was pre-COVID, And now in the era of COVID, it's like something like that becomes even more important. Now there's complications around that now because like we're not really bubbling with our parents, right? I mean, to some extent, you're bubbling with your parents.
Well, my parents live really close by. Right. Your parents live like an hour plus drive away. And frankly, they somehow seem too busy for you still. I don't know how that's possible.
I mean, the fact of the matter, and that brings me to like one other point about this, which is just that like I recognize we're very privileged and
extremely
can build a bubble like this. There's many people for whom this bubble is basically such a thing is basically impossible because there's too many risk events, or they work at a hospital every day, and it's like it doesn't make sense for them to bubble with anyone unless they also work in a hospital. You know, like there's all these kinds of things that make our situation atypical. So I do want to acknowledge that. But my dad works in a hospital, and you basically are you at Drive Napping are, you know, in some
ways, as I've said, I've decided that COVID is not a good fit for me.
Yeah. So basically, COVID could have ruinous health consequences for Adjoive Napping. And so it doesn't make sense for me to bubble with my dad who goes to hospital, you know, and works in a hospital in person. So anyway, I guess I'm saying like there are challenges to working that out now, but in general, the concept I think is a good one of, you know, intergenerational living and things like that. So anyway, I guess if you're out there listening to this this is getting your mind spinning up, my encouragement would be contemplate possibilities outside of what.
Yeah, I don't think
paradigm.
It's like yeah. everyone should bubble.
No.
But I think it's more like think more broadly if there are any actions available to you. Like really, really think hard about doing things differently. Because for me, it's been a huge investment in our mental health. Probably our mental health will be damaged just as a result of the, you know, years of traumatic news events under the Trump administration. But if you add, I think for many people who have children, that this is just a complete blur of a time. And there's such profound anxiety. You know, if any big moves are available to you, whether they cost money or just sort of changes in your arrangement, you know, be bold. And it's a form of self-care. And that is in precious, precious short supply right now.
I watched this really interesting episode of Lovecraft Country recently, season 1, episode 8, that takes place during the death of Emmett Till. And there's these characters in the show, which takes place in the 50s, and they basically, these two black women interact with each other, and they say, like, they couldn't bear to, like, go to Emmett Till's funeral or, like, take pictures because one of them is a photographer. And instead they were, like, thinking about other things that, like, made them feel good instead that day. And one of them said to the other how, like, taking care of yourself is still extremely important during these challenging times.
I think it might have been Audre Lorde. I'm not sure who said originally that, like, if you are a black woman, self-care is like a radical act in and of itself.
Mm. Anyway, random thought, what you made me think of just now. And I'm not saying that was obviously written by a specific audience for a specific audience. I'm not saying it applies in all situations, but it did strike me that, like, in general, people who are going through challenging times, self-care is important. So contemplate ways in which that can happen for you.
Speaking of bubbles, can I change the topic slightly?
Do it. Do it.
Congratulations to the LA Lakers, who have tonight won their championship, LeBron James's fourth? I think it's fourth. Game 6 was tonight. But really, congratulations to the NBA for pulling off that NBA bubble and setting an example to other sports
yes.
of what player safety should look like. Yes, is it depressing and isolating for people to spend time in the bubble? It was. Yes, did a handful of people sneak away? Yes. But like the amount of effort and technology, like they were basically, I don't want to call it prisoners, but they were tracked with like extreme diligence to make sure that all the risk events, first of all, were probably prevented, but then like you would know who congregated with whom for contact tracing, right? It would like all be basically automated. And when you contrast this with Major League Baseball, which has had outbreaks, the NFL, which has had a couple outbreaks now, and who they basically tried, rather than bringing everybody to one place to have a concentrated number of games, those sports have tried to kind of keep it going, but with no fans, but still have all the travel and,
right.
you know, the hanging out in close proximity, in the dugout, you know, like it's...
Do they have, are players like restricted from going places like in the NBA bubble? Or do players like live their own lives like in normal times?
I think that there are guidelines, but then like one of the MLB breakouts was because somebody like broke the rules like and went to a party.
Right.
You know, so I don't
know
if it's...
Which would be just much more challenging.
Strictly an honor system. I think there's like ramped up testing, but you know, it's really... The degree to which America has like tried to get sports back, I think is actually like deeply shameful. And I don't know if we'll look back on it in that way. But, you know, there have been a handful of examples of relatively safe events. So the NBA, I want to congratulate for what such difficult circumstances, but providing both the entertainment and distraction, but also like an incredible platform for social justice. Like they really, it really felt like they did all of this in acknowledgement of the moment we're in, which is that we have a pandemic that disproportionately kills Black and Brown people. And the NBA players obviously themselves are disproportionately Black. And I felt that the somberness of the both the pandemic and the racial inequities in our criminal justice system, both like they weren't completely overshadowed by the game, or they weren't shunted to the side by the game, which is what you fear, right? And similarly, congratulations today to Rafael Nadal. The French Open was rescheduled from the earlier, usually it's like around June, to the really like chilly October in Paris. So it was very surreal for the players to be playing it in such cold conditions. I would not say that the French Tennis Federation covered itself in glory in terms of the COVID procedures. They did allow some fans. They had to sit like a certain distance apart, but it didn't look like it was all that safe. Whatever, you know, fine. At the US Open, which was held over more like Labor Day time period in New York, there were no fans at all. And the only people watching basically were the other tennis players and their families. Like you were allowed a very limited number of guests. And that was closer to like a bubble environment for the US Open. But I want to pause today on the French Open because Rafael Nadal has won, I think it's 12 French Opens, which is really, really, really extraordinary. But the important thing in the COVID era is that he beat anti-vaxxer and 100% enemy of science Novak Djokovic. So Novak Djokovic is, I can't say he's the person I like the least in all of sports, but this is a man who in the COVID era decided that he did not think that this was a big deal and therefore created his own tennis tournament in his home country. And there were fans and there was no distancing. And surprise, surprise, a huge percentage of the players themselves got sick because they're like sweating on each other and shaking hands. And there are pictures of them like partying at nightclubs, like during this event, like hugging each other with no masks indoors. And then after he managed to infect a bunch of his friends who were tennis players, he was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Who could have known? Who could have seen this coming? And instead of himself getting a COVID test on the spot, he got on a private plane and flew back to wherever his house was, and then he decided to get tested for COVID. Like, this guy is a mini Trump when it comes to how he views science. And I think he is profoundly toxic in terms of his, you know, masculinity and alphadom. And every time he sets foot on the court, I hope for him to fail. So today, he not only lost in the final of the French Open, he lost the first set without taking a single game, 6-0. It was beautiful. And I really felt like the final score was 6-0, 6-2, 7-5. Like at the end, Nadal was just like, I'll let you have a few. Just to like, because I'm clearly going to win this thing. But I just don't even need to put in that much effort, you know, to actually bring it home. Also, if you watch the highlights, Rafael Nadal was actually incredible. Yes, hooray for that. Another victory for the thinking people.
Couple of thoughts in reaction to that. One of the things that's been really interesting to observe is how, like, you think that this anti-science, anti-intellectualism is a distinctly American thing, but then, like, you see it's actually happening all around the world. Maybe not as intensely as in the United States, but, like, Djokovic is not American, is he, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so that's been one thing that's, like, been eye-opening about the COVID era. The second thing is that it's profoundly sad that the NBA and other sports groups are using better techniques to prevent the spread of COVID transmission than the U.S. government, right? Than the White House. not even for the American people, because obviously that's not what they have in the NBA bubble is not possible for the American people. Like, everyone has a transmitter. It gets, if you get too close to someone, it vibrates and it logs it and all that stuff like that. And everyone's tested with a pulse oximeter every day and registers the temperature and everything like that. Can't necessarily do that for everyone. I'm just talking about the White House, though.
Like, no, so the White House, when they say, like, it's not a big deal, it seems like they really, really, really drank their own Kool-Aid on that.
Yeah.
And so there was an early, I don't know if it was day one or day two, where you and I were talking about, well, which test did Trump receive? Did he use the quickie test, which has the lower accuracy rate, or the real, like, hardcore nasal swab where it feels like they're tickling your brain? And you were like, well, I think they sprung for the good test for the president. And, you know, you and I both assumed he was tested daily. As it turns out, he didn't like the feeling of the nasal swab, so he was not tested daily. And when he was tested with the crappy test. And it is shocking to me, like, that they, like, fundamentally also didn't understand you can test negative before you test positive. That it needs to, like, sort of build up in concentration over time to the point that it's detectable and you're infectious.
Yeah, there's many things about, like, germ theory that they don't seem to fully grasp. So
it's not for a lack of resources. And I think it's actually incredibly embarrassing for, I think it's Abbott who created that sort of quickie test that they used.
So anyway, it's sad that, like, the NBA has better testing regime and COVID protocols than the White House. That's just a huge bummer. And that also, like, many major sports leagues with billions of dollars of backing, like MLB and football and whatever, can't seem to get it right, yet they expect our schools to be open, right, which have far fewer resources.
I think actually for me, what's more depressing is the college football, like, outbreaks on different teams, because football is a contact sport. It's a very, very difficult thing to socially distance during. Even if you are outdoors, also to, like, stay in that kind of shape, it requires a lot of, like, weightlifting. And anyway, I think the head coach of the LSU football team said at one point he thinks the majority of his players have gotten it. And yet these are, like, unpaid amateurs.
Yeah.
Why is it that everyone is doing classes remotely, but these unpaid amateurs are being asked to sacrifice their future careers, their health, you know, short and long term? Maybe it's because it's not really an amateur situation.
Indeed.
Like, at a minimum, they should be receiving a lifetime of free healthcare for what they're going through.
I've been thinking of putting together a piece that kind of summarizes the pieces that kind of defined the Trump era for me. There's, like, a few magazine articles or essays that really, like, I keep going back to them when I think,
like,
about
what?
Like, for instance, like, there's a piece, I think it was in the Atlantic, called, like, The Cruelty is the Point, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I'm just like, yeah, this really captures what it's like to be alive right now. There's a piece at Huffington Post that was like, I don't know how to explain to you that you should care for other people. You know, it's basically like, if you don't believe that we should care for fellow humans, like, I don't know how to convince you of that. But here's one that I really have been thinking about recently. This came out in February of 2020. So this is before even the pandemic really took hold.
Oh, man. Do you remember? It's like, yeah. Parasite.
Parasite won Best Picture. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything was looking good.
The title of this article is Three Cheers for Socialism. It's written by David Bentley Hart. I think it's in Commonweal magazine.
Commonweal?
Yeah.
I don't think I've even heard of.
Yeah. Commonweal magazine. I actually have read this piece to you before when I first read it the first time, but somebody posted it again recently and I'm like, this is a great piece. I'll quote here. It says, quote, Americans are, of course, the most thoroughly and passively indoctrinated people on earth. They know next to nothing as a rule about their own history or the histories of other nations or the histories of the various social movements that have risen and fallen in the past, and they certainly know little or nothing of the complexities and contradictions comprised within words like socialism and capitalism. Chiefly, what they have been trained not to know or even suspect is that in many ways they enjoy far fewer freedoms and suffer under a more intrusive centralized state than do the citizens of countries with more vigorous social democratic institutions. This is at once the most comic and most tragic aspect of the excitable alarm that talk of social democracy or democratic socialism can elicit on these shores. An enormous number of Americans have been persuaded to believe that they are freer in the abstract than, say, Germans or Danes, precisely because they possess far fewer freedoms in the concrete. They are more vulnerable to medical and financial crisis, far more likely to receive inadequate health coverage, far more prone to irreparable insolvency, far more unprotected against predatory creditors, far more subject to income inequality, and so forth, while effectively paying more in tax. I'll stop right there, but basically...
Yes, 1,000%.
There's this idea, that Americans believe we're the greatest country in the world and all these things. We believe all these things about ourselves. And what this virus, this pandemic has shown is that like none of those things are true. We're actually in a much worse state than like many other countries in the world that we think we're better than. And unfortunately...
No, I mean, it's really America like talks about the greatest generation and the greatest country and the greatest liberty and the greatest, you know, and the democracy is so great.
We still describe the president as the quote unquote leader of the free world. Like there's all this...
With a fervor, you know, that is like... I don't want to like make this analogy, so
okay, so don't.
Yeah,
but suffice to no, I'll leave it. But suffice to say that I think that it's shocking.
Can I try it again?
Okay, go ahead with a fervor. Go ahead. Okay,
with a fervor that is like when you see your girlfriend who's like in a bad relationship, and it's been just 5 years of brunches where you catch up and she tells you like 6 awful things he did, but then she's like, but it's going to be okay. Like it's actually great. It's great. I'm so lucky. And you're like, you're not lucky. You should leave. Like that is the feeling I have when I look at our maternal health indicators, our education outcomes. Like there are so many ways in which we lag other countries. And specifically that white people in America lag white people elsewhere. And I specifically think this is a wedge. Like it's a lie we tell ourselves so that we can sort of keep our social order the way it is.
Yeah. And I think that there's been so many things where I think a huge swath of this country doesn't believe it can be better than it is right now. Things like school shootings. Like, we build schools differently. Like, the shape of schools is different, like, physically, you know, so that it's like a curved hallway so that a school shooter can't shoot down it. You know, like, we build schools physically then rather than, like, figure out a way to stop guns from getting in the hands of school shooters. Holding school shooter drills is an act, like, a billion-dollar industry right now. And people just can't imagine that there's any other way that this could be true. There was a great tweet recently that was like, living in America is like, you see all these quote unquote inspirational stories on your timeline about, so-and-so was able to pay $100,000 to stop the orphan crushing machine from crushing orphans. But nobody asks, why is there an orphan crushing machine in the first place? Why did we need to build an orphan crushing machine? Why does it need to have money to be stopped? You know what I mean? Like nobody asks these questions. And
what I find amazing is that it is such a deeply held belief. I mean, I do sometimes wonder if it's brittle because some people like are protecting it again, like that girlfriend at brunch who just can't stop smiling through the pain. But because Americans are so optimistic, they're so happy, like literally, you know, people from other countries that many of which frankly have better outcomes on some of these indicators will come over and be like, oh, it's so refreshing to be in America because everyone's just like so forward looking. And, you know, yeah, if you don't know your history, you're definitely forward looking, you know. And I think it's weird because it works. Mm. It quote unquote works to make us more economically productive and less depressed. And, you know, but it's also like a set of contradictions. It's very hard to hold
well,
in your
head.
And
now we're reaching the breaking point, I think. I mean, I think the idea is like, hey, yeah, healthcare. Oh, breaking your leg might financially ruin you for the rest of your life. You know, like that's a thing we're willing to accept. Active school shooter drills. Like, yeah, sure. Why not? That's all just part of living in the freedom. And now it's like the pandemic and like people just have a lack of imagination, I think, about what life can be like, which is to say what it's like in other countries where they don't deal with this shit.
I mean, I think that's a little harsh to say people have a lack of imagination. I think people are highly aligned that it would be nicer to have fewer school shootings. I think my observation is that I think we have extraordinary levels of frog in boiling water syndrome, that if we were to have like time machine from 10 years ago to today in terms of the school shootings, people would be up, you know, in the streets, which they, many of them already are, to be fair. But there's something about like the gradual nature of it that like people become accustomed to ever more hellacious events.
Fair enough. But I still think my point is correct as well, which is people can't imagine life being better. And if there's one thing we can close on today, imagine that life can be better. Imagine that we, a world where we don't need to deal with all this shit. Because we believe in science and intellectualism and...
Well, and that your intellectualism doesn't threaten me and call me unintellectual.
Yeah. And in the forward march of progress in humanity. The arc of history is long, but it ultimately bends towards justice. So, any closing thoughts at Joy of Napping?
Well, as we record this, it's... I guess it's about 3 weeks to the election, which is surreal. And then the date I'm really thinking toward is what happens in January. I believe Biden will win the popular vote. TBD on the Electoral College. But there's a lot of... I don't think we know November 4th who the next president will be. So it's going to be a pretty wild ride. And I think for every single one of us, take care of yourselves. Be kind to people around you. It's going to take a lot of psychic energy. Even if you have family that are Trump supporters, you know, like I don't presume that every Trump supporter is a bad person. And I think literally everyone is very anxious about this election. And so let's all just try to get through it as humans.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culturally Relevant. Again, you can follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. And this podcast was powered by Simplecast. Check out simplecast.com for a great solution for powering and managing your podcast. Thanks, Joy of Napping, for joining me today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to the patrons out there for making this podcast possible. We'll see you next week.